You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farad. Coming up, we'll talk to Stephen Thompson from NPR Music about some of his favorite albums of 2016.
First, 17 federal intelligence agencies came to the consensus that Russia was behind the hacks into Democratic Party computers and aimed at influencing the November election. The consensus comes after President-elect Donald Trump and his supporters expressed doubts that there was enough evidence to show that Russia was responsible for the hacking.
Last week, President Obama said that he plans on taking action against Russia for trying to meddle in U.S. elections. Here's a clip from a conversation he had with NPR's Steve Inskeep.
I think there is no doubt that when any foreign government tries to impact the integrity of our elections, that we need to take action, and we will, at a time and place of our own choosing. Some of it may be explicit and publicized, some of it may not be. But Mr. Putin is well aware of my feelings about this because I spoke to him directly about it.
Obama was also careful to say that while the hacks were to Trump's benefit, he wasn't saying that the Trump campaign had a role in the attacks.
Michael Sullmeyer joins us now. He's the cybersecurity project director at the Harvard Kennedy School, and he previously worked in the office of the Secretary of Defense, where he served as director for plans and operations for cyber policy. Michael, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Before we dig into some of the history of Russian cyber attacks, the big question now seems to be the intelligence community is saying these attacks came from Russia. The Donald Trump campaign and those around him are raising doubts about it. How do we know, if we're looking at a particular cyber attack, where it came from?
That's a great question. Attribution for a long time has been a topic that scholars and practitioners have debated, and that it's hard, but it's not nearly as hard as it used to be. And that's because, A, there's a lot more entities now watching what happens in cyberspace as opposed to 10 years ago. And B, there's a lot of private sector groups, companies that make money off of writing about it, that put information out there as well. So in a paper that Ben Buchanan and I recently wrote for the Carnegie Endowment, we go through the evidence that we see that's public. But you've also heard that President Obama will be releasing some additional information before January 20, providing what the government has to clarify why they believe Russia was behind the hacks.
So you're thinking that this is legit, that Russian operatives working for elements of the Russian government were interfering in the U.S. election?
They were certainly trying to interfere. Mm-hmm. What's been hard to discern is exactly what the effect has been and at a technical level what the effect was, but there was certainly the attempt to interfere, and everything that I've seen points to Russian origins. You heard the president talk about his thoughts about why if something goes on in Russia, it's unlikely that President Putin doesn't know about it. But the fact that it became such a topic of conversation and these allegations that the system was rigged and linking that to hacking when the president-elect as a candidate called for more hacking to be done against his opponent, that was very problematic to hear.
Now, you've written in a paper for the Task Force on U.S. Policy Toward Russia, Ukraine, and Eurasia that, quoting here, the Russian cyber threat is significant but hardly catastrophic. It's neither new nor unprecedented. I want to get into that precedent here. This goes back a couple decades, doesn't it, with the first big Russian attack in the U.S.?
That's absolutely right. And we talk about this a little bit more in the paper and have some good citations for those who want to go deep. But what we also are trying to focus on is that even the most sophisticated actors in cyberspace don't always need to use the most sophisticated tools or the most sophisticated techniques. So as we talk about the Russian ability to collect information, what we would ordinarily think of as espionage, they've been in this business a long time. And they're not the only ones who have been in that business a long time. We've been in that business a long time also. What we focus on in the paper and what I hope people will keep an eye on going forward, 2017 and beyond, is the ability for states like Russia and others to hold some of our critical infrastructure at risk through cyber operations. That is, being able to create effects in physical infrastructure if they wanted to, as a result of having established a presence through cyberspace.
Talking to Michael Sollmeyer from the Harvard Kennedy School, looking at cyber warfare accusations that Russia attempted to interfere in the U.S. presidential elections, just one of the possible elements of cyber warfare out there from Russia and others. And let's follow up on that infrastructure point. Russia's demonstrated its power to do some things like that, hasn't it, in Ukraine and elsewhere?
Exactly right. There was a situation earlier this year, end of last year, where power in part of Ukraine was taken offline, and all signs there again pointed to Russian origins. It's also worth noting that in an indictment unsealed earlier this year, our Justice Department indicted several Iranians for trying to hack into a dam in New York and the control system that powered that dam, which was an environmental preserve, it looked like. It was physically offline at the time, so it does not appear that there was true physical risk. But so when I say the Russians aren't the only ones who have been trying to hold that kind of infrastructure at risk.
As you mentioned earlier, the United States engages in information gathering around the world in various ways, including cyber intelligence. There have been accusations that the U.S. used cyber attacks, I believe, in Iran in the past. Are we on any kind of moral high ground on these issues?
Well, the reality is, you know, it's a dangerous world, and it's a time where so many different parts of the world are in a period of transition or in a period of crisis or struggle, and the ability to make sure that our decision makers have the access to as much reliable information as possible collected in a variety of different ways. You never want to just rely on one particular source or method. That's a really important requirement for our government and for our administration going forward.
Is this a really effective, a cost-effective method at establishing one's influence in the world? I mean, Russia could put a lot of money into building, I don't know, more aircraft carriers, or human intelligence could take a lot of time and a lot of money. Cyber intelligence, by comparison, is pretty cheap, isn't it?
Yeah, that's a great point. It is relatively cheap, especially compared to an aircraft carrier or something else that gives you more overt physical presence. So not only is it's cheap, but cyber capabilities offer the owner an opportunity to be quite stealthy about how they are seen, when they are seen, and the kind of effects they can generate. It's a very, very flexible tool.
And Michael, one point you raise in that paper I referenced earlier is that Russia is doing something a little different. A lot of countries are collecting information via some form of hacking. They've weaponized it a little bit by releasing it publicly. Is there a lot of precedent for that so far?
There's not a lot of precedent for it. It's a good observation. But that's what marks the distinction between what I would interpret as a traditional intelligence gathering or collection activity, breaking in and stealing information, versus then weaponizing that information, or in this case, releasing that information publicly to achieve an effect, in this case, to undermine the integrity of how Americans feel about the election. So that has not been a regular tactic. I don't believe it's the first time, but it's certainly not a regular tactic for intelligence activities.
We're talking to Michael Sollmeyer, Cybersecurity Project Director at the Harvard Kennedy School. We're looking at the growing consensus from intelligence agencies that Russian hacking aims to interfere with the U.S. election.
And we want to hear from you. You can call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. What do you think of allegations of Russian hacking in the election campaign? How do you think that the U.S. should respond? How much does this worry you, if at all? And do you believe that President Obama, who only has a month left in the White House, should be doing anything? Do you think Donald Trump should be taking action? Our number is 800-642-1234.
We're continuing our conversation now with Michael Sollmeier, Cybersecurity Project Director at the Harvard Kennedy School, talking about Russian hacking aimed at meddling in the U.S. election.
And we want to hear from you. You can call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Do you agree with the intelligence community that Russian hackers aim to influence the U.S. election? How should President Obama respond, if you think he should respond at all? And tell us how you think President-elect Donald Trump might respond to intelligence about this alleged Russian hacking. You can call 800-642-1234.
And Michael, you've written that we need better defense, better detection, and better deterrence. I want to take those one at a time. Better defense, what would that look like in the cyber realm?
Sure. The reality is that while the United States probably has the nicest rocks in cyberspace, we also live in the glassiest house. And so we have to make sure that in the years going forward, we make our house a little less glassy so that we can defend ourselves better. There's a couple different aspects to it. One is we've got to, first, our government needs to defend its own federal government networks, like military networks, White House network. And second, the federal government needs to figure out how it's going to help businesses and other institutions within the United States have the security benefits of the kind of information that our government has. And this is why the Obama administration has spent such a long time trying to improve information sharing between the public and the private sector. There's a lot more to do, but that's a really good place to start.
Before we get back to detection and deterrence, let's bring on a caller. Virginia is with us in Portage. Virginia, hi.
Hi. Well, I was wondering about, am I still on the call?
You're still going, Virginia. Go for it.
Oh, okay, because the car is going. So I was wondering in terms of international business has become almost more fewer boundaries between nations, and what is the future of international law in terms of looking at these things? Because obviously laws from country to country aren't going to be as consistent.
Virginia, thanks for the call. Michael, it's an international problem. Do we have international law to match?
It's a great question, Virginia. You are right on track with many in the international law community who have spent time trying to figure out how developments in cyberspace affect and reflect international law. So far, the consensus has been that international law and the law of armed conflict continue to apply in cyberspace, just like they do in other areas of potential conflict between and among nations. But the reality is there are going to be evolutions that have to occur in just in terms of property and tax and all other aspects of law to account for the sort of non-jurisdictional nature of cyberspace. So it's a great question that I try to get law students and master's students interested in researching. And time will tell just how much it changes.
Thanks for the call, Virginia. We'll go next to Jim on the line in Hartford. Jim, hi.
Hi there. Hi, Michael. Hey, I think we're missing one big question that just gets skipped over. Are we talking, as far as the Russian hacking going, are we talking about about the WikiLeaks information? Because we know it's not related to the machines. And if we're talking about the WikiLeaks information that is being hacked, I think the WikiLeaks is pretty much the closest thing we have to real news. And I really think this Russian hacking thing is a fake story. I think this is the definition of fake news. I really do.
Fake in what sense, Jim?
Well, you're saying Russian hacking, but nobody's saying what the actual hack was. Was it the WikiLeaks?
Gotcha, Jim. I hear where you're coming from. So to be clear, nobody's saying that Russians hacked election voting machines. A good point of clarification, Jim. Michael, refresh us. What was hacked that ended up at WikiLeaks?
Yeah, thanks, Jim. It's a good opportunity for clarification. I think the question that emerges is where did the information that appeared on WikiLeaks, where did it come from? Right, where did the all the John Podesta emails, where did that come from? Why did they become public? How did they become public? And that's really the question of the role of the Russian hackers that has been the focus of the conversation. And it's that the allegation is that the Russians were the ones who achieved unauthorized access into different computer networks and into different email accounts, removed that information, and then through probably a couple different channels provided it to, among others, WikiLeaks and DC Leaks. So I think that's how the chain of custody may go.
Jim, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Michael Sulmeier, Cybersecurity Project Director at the Harvard Kennedy School, looking at allegations of Russian hacking related to the U.S. elections. Michael, wanted to get back to your three-part plan here. Better defense, better detection is the next step. And you write that there's been a long-term effort by Russian operations to find loopholes, find future opportunities. What would we have to do to detect an ongoing effort like that?
Yeah, the detection, on the one hand, we have reasons to be optimistic because our government and so many other allied governments have spent a lot of money and a lot of time over the last several years getting better at detecting malicious activity in cyberspace. So there's one area, at least, of hope. The difficulty is that for the aggressor or for the criminal or the perpetrator, there's always new techniques they come up with to evade and to hide and be stealthy. So it's always going to be a cat and mouse game. But what's changed, I think, in the last several years is that it's now almost impossible to be completely anonymous in cyberspace. And today, you'll likely be seen. It may take a little time to figure out exactly who you are as the perpetrator, but now you'll be detected more likely than not.
You know, it occurs to me, Michael, that often the most vulnerable point of any system is likely to be the person sitting in front of the terminal, where a phishing scheme or something like that, they click on the wrong link, and that ultimately opens up the door to a lot of secured or hopefully secured information. What can we do to help limit the damage that can be done by the human link here?
Well, that's a great observation, then. A colleague at the Belfer Center, where I work, has a paper in the Harvard Business Review from last year that talks a lot about that. Sandy Winnefeld wrote that paper. And the reality is that more training, more education, and more thinking like the how to better help the human is a big element of getting better at cybersecurity. However, and I think where we need to have a much more serious conversation is, why are humans left in the position of being able to cause so much harm to themselves and to the network and to others? And that's going to be a larger question of what are the role that Internet service providers play, right? Is it the wild, wild west when you sign up for Comcast or RCN Internet service? Or are they going to play a more active role in security? And finally, what's the role of the federal government going to be in holding these entities accountable for better cybersecurity online?
Getting back to your recommendations for the future, better defense, better detection, and better deterrence. And we've heard President Obama talking about retaliation. What would that look like? What kind of things can we do to deter cyber attacks on the U.S.?
Yeah, great question. The issue to deter a cyber attack on the United States, you have to make sure that the potential perpetrator is very clear that they will face a cost in an area where they are vulnerable. And that area where the adversary is vulnerable is not necessarily where we're vulnerable. I said that we live in the glassiest house in cyberspace. That doesn't mean that our adversaries live in an equally glassy house. So what deterrence looks like in this situation may not be threatening more or retaliatory cyber attacks. Quite the contrary, it could mean, for example, cutting off access to international banking, something that could be very valuable for a certain regime. But for us or for other states, there may have plenty of other alternatives. So look for a cross-domain or asymmetric solution to deter.
What do we do about our infrastructure? Do we have a lot of things in place that were, you know, servers and whatever that were put in place before we were worried about cyber attacks? And as we see the new Internet of Things, the refrigerators and things like that have already been used in cyber attacks. Do we need to go back and redo everything we've done?
That's a great question, and I fear that at least in the short term, we do need to have a hard look at how vulnerable we are making our infrastructure by connecting different systems that were never designed to be connected to the Internet, and yet we go ahead and we connect them to the Internet. So I think developers and manufacturers are going to have to invest more in security. We're going to have to look at upgrading the existing series of control systems. And finally, in the immediate short term, it may be prudent to just take certain systems offline and disconnect them from such easy access to the Internet until you've had a chance to audit the kind of security vulnerability that you acquire by putting it immediately on the Internet.
Michael, what's next? Are we at the beginning of an unstoppable cyber arms race, or can we put in place some international law that lets us play nicer together?
Well, it's a good question, and I have to imagine, just based on what we've seen over the last several months, that there's no slowdown coming in the conflict that's emerging in cyberspace. Quite the contrary, other states around the world use it and look at it as a tool against the United States that, as you had pointed out earlier, is relatively cheap, can be relatively stealthy, and can impose some cost on us without being so escalatory to demand a kinetic response. It's too attractive right now for a lot of states. So we're going to have to do a lot better at improving our defenses, making sure we're detecting the adversaries, try as they may, and ultimately sending a clear deterrent message that serious cyber attacks won't be tolerated.
Michael, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for the time. It was a pleasure.
That's Michael Solmeyer. He's the Cybersecurity Project Director at the Harvard Kennedy School and previously worked in the Office of the Secretary of Defense, where he served as Director for Plans and Operations for Cyber Policy. He joined us to talk about what the future holds after intelligence agencies agreed that Russian hackers aimed to influence the 2016 U.S. election. 2016 was in some ways a dark year in the music world. We lost legends like Prince, David Bowie, Leonard Cohen, Sharon Jones, Merle Haggard, and Beatles producer Sir George Martin, just to name a few. But while 2016 may be remembered for these losses, there was still a lot of good music that did come out this year.
Stephen Thompson is an editor and reviewer for NPR Music and a panelist on Pop Culture Happy Hour and All Songs Considered. He joins us on Central Times a few times a year to share what he's been listening to. And today we asked him to zero in on his favorite albums from the past year, and he's been writing about that at NPR. Stephen, welcome back.
That's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, Stephen, you said that 2016 to you was the year of great albums that embodied a sense of mystery. What did you hear?
Yeah, I just noticed the way that a lot of the best and most critically acclaimed albums of the year weren't just like bundles of MP3s. They weren't just collections of, you know, like, here are my 10 potential singles. They had an air of something more to them. You know, so you talk about like the Beyoncé record Lemonade that so many people love, including myself, and it came packaged with this long-form video that was very, very provocative and had a lot of people talking about the songs even before the record had come out. A record like this, a Frank Ocean record, Blonde, that came out in several different forms, you know, that rolled out over the course of several days. Even something like the David Bowie record, you know, it's obviously not a marketing ploy, but that record came out and David Bowie died 2 days later. And you start to then, in hindsight, get a sense that this record was made with mortality looming over it. And so many of the records that we're going to talk about today and that were the best records of this year were albums that had that air of a lot of thought being put into them as a whole.
And Stephen, before we get to the albums, I want to revisit a question we've asked you before. You know, we can buy songs one at a time really easy online now. They're hit singles, a lot of them. The album, though, it sounds like you're saying, is still surviving and doing just fine as an art form.
Yeah, I think if anything, the album is expanding as a format. Kanye West put out an album this year called The Life of Pablo that was basically never actually finished. He only put it out on streaming services and was constantly tinkering with it, was changing the track listing and taking songs out and putting songs in and, you know, offering different cuts of them. And it was basically this perpetually unfinished project, but you'd still call it an album, you know. And so I think the definition of what even constitutes an album has really evolved over the course of this year.
Well, Stephen, I want to dive into your list of your top 10 favorite albums from 2016. And number one reveals maybe, I don't know, just guessing a little bit about your love of Wisconsin, too. Tell us about your number one.
Yeah, I mean, I swear to God, it's not because he's from Wisconsin. But I am a huge fan of Justin Vernon, of Bon Iver, who has now made three full-length albums, all of which I think are very not only very beautiful and very evocative and very engrossing, but all three are very, very different. His first record for Emma Forever Ago came out about a decade ago, and it's just this whisper of kind of these acoustic recordings, these kind of bare bones acoustic recordings that were, recorded in a Wisconsin cabin, very famously. And then his second record a few years later is these very grandiose, kind of almost orchestrally arranged, just big booming songs. And this record, which is called 22 a Million, numeral 22 comma a million, is kind of meets somewhere in the middle. It's this kind of strange warped, I describe it as like a scuffed jewel, where these songs are so beautiful and so delicate, but they have this abrasive quality to them, this almost warped quality to them. And it has this kind of, it feels almost like it's beamed from a distant satellite. And I just love it. And it's another one of these records. A lot of the songs all have like numbers in them, and there's this kind of coded quality even to the way the song titles are presented. There are codes all over the album art. Again, it's an air of mystery. He put so much thought into this record that I'm sure there's stuff in it that only he understands. And I love that about it.
Here's a taste of the track 8 Circle from the new Bon Iver album, 22 a Million.
Stephen, just briefly before we leave Justin Vernon, there had been speculation that he would not keep producing under the band Bon Iver. He still is. This is a new album, and it's a good one, you say, a great one. Do you think this is a band that's going to have legs and keep going, or do you think we just don't know?
God, I really hope so, And I think that feeds into the air of mystery. He had given a bunch of interviews in the last couple of years, and he'd certainly made plenty of other music. He's somebody who loves to work with other artists, not only as a performer, but as a producer. He'd made these great records under the name Volcano Choir with members of a band from Milwaukee called Collections of Colonies of Bees that I think were gorgeous. I think it was specifically the Bon Iver name that he wasn't sure he still wanted to work with. I think there was so much pressure. He won a couple of Grammy Awards, and it was kind of like he was becoming very mainstream in a way that I don't know that he was comfortable with. So the fact that he went back and still worked under the Bon Iver name and with the kind of Bon Iver aesthetic was so exciting to me as such a huge fan. This is his first Bon Iver record in 5 years. Boy, I hope he keeps doing it forever.
Talking to Stephen Thompson from NPR Music, looking at his top 10 albums of the year. Let's move on now and give a listen to another one. Beyonce, her album Lemonade. Here's the track Sorry. So talk about this as not a collection of singles, but as an album, Stephen.
Yeah, Lemonade is definitely an album. And, obviously when it came out, it was so heavily discussed in the context of how it fits into Beyoncé's personal life and Beyoncé's marriage. And as such, it is a very powerful record, and it's a very personal record. And yet, it is also making larger, grander statements about Black womanhood in 2016, and coined all these phrases that entered the lexicon over the course of the year. Hot sauce in my bag, and all these different phrases that people picked up over time. And I think what sometimes gets lost in that discussion, all of which is a very worthwhile discussion, is how diverse it is in sound. You have a song like Sorry, which is just this very springy, kind of elastic, R&B pop single that's so incredibly catchy and, you know, has multiple different hooks in it. But there's also a song on this record that's like a rock song. There's a song on this record that's a country song. There are anthems, there are ballads, and she's working in so many different styles within pop music and doing it in such a creative way.
And Stephen, you draw attention to a song that you call your best American girl. You say it's the best song of the year. And I love it. I've never heard it before. And this is an artist that I'm not familiar with, but this one I was listening to, it just went, just blew me away. I love this song. Tell us about
She's great. It's a singer named Mitski, and this is her second record. It's called Puberty 2, with the numeral 2, and it's all these songs about identity and finding your place in the world and in your relationships. And this particular song, it starts with all these kind of whispery details about this intimate relationship, and she's addressing her partner or her lover as her big spoon. She's the little spoon and he's the big spoon, and it's kind of sweet and romantic. And then as the song fans out and builds into these bigger and bigger choruses, she's touching on like sort of socially and culturally how she fits into his life and with his family and in society. And the song is called Your Best American Girl, and it is far and away my favorite song of the year.
All right, here's a listen. Mitski, Your Best American Girl. I love how the distorted guitar comes in there. And that's well into the song at that point.
Yeah, and I mean, it's got that, quiet, loud quality that so many, big rock songs have.
And that Stephen Thompson loves.
That I love, absolutely. She's just a tremendous talent and a tremendous live performer. That song is just made to, I'd play it in the car, and every 15 to 25 seconds, I would lean over and just turn it up a little louder, a little louder, a little louder.
We'll continue our conversation with Stephen Thompson from NPR Music about his top album picks of 2016.
And we'd love to hear from you on this, too, at 800-642-1234. Is there an album from the year that really stood out for you that you've been listening to, notching up on the radio, a singer maybe, or a group whose new album you were eagerly awaiting, maybe it delivered this year? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickard, and we're continuing our conversation with NPR Stephen Thompson about his picks for the best albums of 2016.
Checking out one of them right now, and you can share your favorite albums, songs new to you, albums new to you at 800-642-1234. And do you listen to albums, or do you just collect individual songs? 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And there's an abundance of talent going on in this song here. This is, I don't know, maybe it's a new super group that's come out in 2016. Stephen, what can you tell us about Case Langviers?
Yeah, you said the word yourself. It's a super group. It's Nico Case, Katie Lang, and Laura Viers. And when I found out that this album was about to exist, I remember immediately thinking, oh, that's too good to be true. There's absolutely no way that it can possibly be the sum of those parts. If any one of those women were putting out an album, I would be excited about it. And so to have them all put it out at once, and then the songwriting is enormously consistent, and what I love about it is it really does manage to capture the songwriting voices and the singing voices of all three of those performers. They are all front women. They are all band leaders. They are all, people who just have such a strong presence, and yet they're able to share center stage in a really interesting way and kind of take turns in the spotlight, but then have the others back them up in beautiful ways. And so I just love this record. I love every song on this record. It's not necessarily like a massively groundbreaking record. It's not, doesn't necessarily fit into the category of something that's incredibly mysterious. It's just sturdy songcraft with these wonderful voices and these wonderful singers that I always enjoy.
Case Lang veers there. We'll go to our callers now. Thatcher is with us in La Crosse. Thatcher, hi.
Hi. I was just calling to talk about John Bellion. He's a newer artist that came out, I think, in 2015, but he's really come up this year. And it's John Bellion. It's J-O-N-B-E-L-L-I-O-N.
Okay, and what kind of music, Thatcher? What kind of genre or what have you?
He's kind of like electronic pop, if you could say. He's very electronic, but he's very poppy at the same time, and so kind of multi-genre, I guess.
Thatcher, thanks a lot for the suggestion, John Bellion. Steven, not one I know on your radar?
I just wrote down the name John Bellion.
It's always fun. You get ones to check out, too.
So I'll be checking it out. Yeah, that sounds great.
Thanks a lot, Thatcher. Let's take another call from Gerhard in Milwaukee. Gerhard, hi.
Hello. How are you tonight?
Good, thanks. What did you want to share?
I was wondering comments about Leonard Cohen's latest album, since it just came out in October, and then he passed away in November 8th.
Right, Leonard Cohen. Thank you, Gerhard. Another heavy hitter there that we lost this year, Stephen. What did you think about that last album?
Yeah, it's a natural companion piece in a way to the David Bowie record Black Star, where it was clearly made and released with the understanding that Leonard Cohen's own mortality was imminent. And I think Leonard Cohen has been singing about variations on his own mortality for many, many years now. But this record, I think, really did manage to hit harder. It's called You Want It Darker, and it lives up to its title. It is a very very gloomy but very beautiful record about death and life and redemption. It's very powerful, but you know, it's not an easy listen. it is a terrific record though, and a great suggestion.
And you've mentioned David Bowie's newest last album a couple times. Here's a listen to the track from Black Star, I Can't Give Everything Away.
I know something's very wrong. Prodigal sons with blackouts, hearts with flowered news, with skull designs upon my shoes. I can't give everything.
And not as difficult listening as it sounds like the Leonard Cohen was, but still, I mean, a farewell in a lot of ways.
And still, once this came out, a record I had to put aside for a while because I was just so sad.
Too soon. Yeah.
And I think that just the title of that song, I Can't Give Everything Away, as the final track on David Bowie's final record, is just a really powerful statement in and of itself. I mean, just think about the double meaning and, like, I can't give everything away. Like, you're putting so much of yourself out into the world as a singer and a songwriter, but you want to retain a certain element of mystery at the same time. And so it's, in a way, it's kind of a mantra for what I was talking about how much of 2016's best music retained that air of mystery.
And you've got one country album on the list from an artist called Maren Morris. So what do we need to know about her?
Oh, she's just terrific. Just a really, just a young, sparkling singer-songwriter. There's a bunch of great country music. It was an embarrassment of riches to try to pin down a top 10 list. There are great records by, oh my gosh, right off the top, Miranda Lambert had a great record. Jeez, I'm of course off the top of my head. But this Maren Morris record is just full of these big kind of hit and hit worthy anthems. She kind of broke through late last year with a song called My Church, which was like a big country hit that I just loved and spun over and over again. She had a big summer hit with Rich, which was just one of my favorite country songs of the year. Just a very charismatic and fun singer-songwriter who manages to weave in, you know, like sounds almost of like classic rock into her country music. This might have been a collection of singles as opposed to like a completely thematically sound album, but it was a collection of very, very good singles.
Here's one of the songs Stephen just mentioned, "Rich" by Maren Morris.
Had a dollar every time that I swore you off, and a 20 every time that I picked up when you called, and a crisp new Benjamin for when you hear.
I mentioned this last time we talked to you, and I think you mentioned Steve Miller when you referred the song to your piece, because I'm a joker, I'm a smoker, and so on. That's a pretty similar feel there.
It has that kind of running through it.
There's the chorus right now.
And it's so funny, I was blanking a second ago on great country records in 2016. Sturgill Simpson, that's a great record. Brandi Clark, Aubrey Sellers. I could keep on naming them.
And Maren Morris, she had some great lines in her songs. There's one about, if I had a dime for every time something, something, I'd be sitting on a big pile of dimes.
On a big old pile of dimes.
A big old pile of dimes.
Yeah, right. It's wordplay, and sometimes it's also just direct, straight to the gut, very plain spoken songwriting. She's wonderful. I really, really like her a lot and can't wait to hear what she does next.
Let's listen at least one more. How about, so you loved Beyonce, but she's not the only member of that family on your list. Solange. Beyonce's often best known as her sister, but no, you say she's got a great album all on her own.
Oh, absolutely. It was an embarrassment of Knowles family riches in 2016. This Solange record, it's called A Seat at the Table, and it's a much... naturally, you're going to compare it to Beyonce's record, and you're going to naturally compare her to Beyonce, but she is very, very much her own songwriter and her own voice. And this record is this kind of slow-burning, very subtle, much quieter rumination on identity in 2016 and representation in 2016. With a lot of these, ordinarily I don't necessarily like it when albums are filled with interludes, but this record uses its interludes very wisely. A lot of spoken word samples and conversation mixed in with these very luminous and smart and interesting songs, many of which are ballads. I love this record a lot.
Here's the song "Cranes in the Sky" by Solange from the album A Seat at the Table.
Tried to drink it away. I tried to put one in the air. I tried to dance it away. I tried to change it with my hair.
And Stephen, I want to end with something seasonal. I happened to see this quote from you on Twitter today. My heart is an icy clump of greasy gutter slush, but the song by Low melted it just enough for me to feel again. Just briefly, Stephen, what do you like about the song we're going to play by Low?
I mean, I feel like that tweet just said it all. Low's a band from Duluth. They've been around for 20 plus years. One of my favorite bands. They play very slow, very quiet, kind of methodical sounding music. And their specialty to me, they have so much great music, but their Christmas music is just glorious. They have an album from 1999 called Christmas that everyone should own and play around the holidays. This particular song is gorgeous. It's called Some Hearts at Christmas Time.
We'll leave it there with you now, Stephen. Thanks a lot, as always, for joining us.
Thank you.
Stephen Thompson, editor and reviewer for NPR Music and All Songs Considered. His full list linked on the Central Time Facebook page.